You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello hosting the program Ask the Lawyer that we present usually on the last Saturday of every month. I'm here in our studio, our radio studio today, with another esteemed colleague and lawyer, Vince DeAngelis. Vince, how are you today?
Joe, good morning to you.
Good morning. In fact, good morning to everybody on this Easter weekend. And we're going to be continuing with our discussions on wills and estates planning. We'll call it Wills and Estates Planning Part 3. In a few moments, we'd like to remind the people listening to us today on the English station that if they have any questions or comments that they would like to make or share with us, we'd be happy to receive their calls. And we have a phone number that people can call in directly to the studio. It's area code 416. We're here in Toronto. Area code 416. The phone number is 245-1534, 245-1534. Your comments and questions are always appreciated. We do get emails from time to time during the week from people who may have listened to the original broadcast. Don't be afraid to be shy or even to, if you catch it on a representation, to send any questions along to Radio Maria, and we'll try to address them in the future. So in the first two segments that Vince and I have been discussing together, we've talked about basic situations with wills and powers of attorney, how they're set up, why they're important. And in our last segment, we talked about some taxation aspects, which were very important in terms of this time of the year with respect to RSPs and registered retirement income funds and other issues relating to estates planning. And so today we thought we would discuss a bit more about what occurs or what kind of planning we do when someone actually passes away. So they've passed away and we're at a situation where we often see families and they want to know what it is that they are supposed to do more than often. And so the question becomes this whole question of probate, or what we call today, I guess, would be, that's the old English term, and what we would today call estate administration in Ontario, although everybody still talks about probate, right, Vince? Is that your general view of things? It's a common word that everybody knows in English?
Well, that's right. The formal term where there's a will is that the estate representative normally called the executor in the case of a will, applies for what's called a certificate of appointment of estate trustee with a will. And right. If there's no will, we used to call the application being for letters of administration. And now the person would apply for a certificate of appointment of a state trustee without a will. But we call both situations, normally the colloquial we commonly use is, as you said, probate, which is more commonly understood and more easier to
right. It has a great legal tradition. It appears a few hundred years, it appears. And of course, very often when we Vince and I both meet with respective clients, we always encounter a variety of situations and things have occurred. And I know that we have oftentimes stressed the importance of planning, estate planning in particular, at any point in anyone's life, so that if something happens, things happen in a more orderly fashion. But unfortunately, the world is as it is, and a lot of time people are not aware of things, and sometimes things happen even without wills. And sometimes people often have a misapprehension as to what happens. We'll talk about maybe some specific general situations you see from time to time, but But in the old days, Vince wouldn't know because he's much younger than myself, but in the old days, which is about 39 years ago when I was called to the bar, and we used to do real estate transactions, if a client passed away, it was actually pretty simple, you know. The client would come in, usually would be, you know, the spouse or somebody, if they had a will, you'd take the will, you'd deposit it. That was the old word. You deposit it on title. There was no such thing as electronic registration, which any lawyer, I guess, practicing less than about 20 years would not be familiar with. And, you know, we used to search everything by hand. We had people called title searchers, you know, and they had these big old dusty books that they would open up and look at all the details. And this was the old English system. And we used to deposit the will on title. So if the will said, I leave my house to my wife, you deposit the will, let's say for some reason it was owned by him, you just transfer it to the guy's wife. And that was it. There wasn't really much of anything that happened. You could proceed that way. And it was very commonly done. It was a very informal process. And that's like ancient history. It's not done like that anymore. And so we see situations today, unfortunately, where people did things 20, 30, 40 years ago that might have been valid or might have been something that they thought was okay, that's no longer okay and can lead to problems. And I think one of the most common things that we have seen, with especially with older clients who have had property, is where they've made themselves owners of a property jointly with their kids. Vince, have you had that situation ever arise in recent history about property being owned jointly with parents and their children?
Well, yes. They very often the parents, in order to avoid paying probate fees, will hold property jointly with one or more children. The reason behind that is you can bypass the need for probate altogether with that respect to that specific property
and
by holding it jointly.
Just to remind our listeners that when we talk about probate, we're talking, the government of Ontario doesn't like to call it a tax, right? They like to think of it as just a fee for providing the service to apply to the court to obtain letters of administration, or to obtain what we call probate, a legal authority to deal with the deceased assets. But effectively, it's a 1.5% tax on the asset of the persons, right?
Correct. So the executor obtains his or her authority from the will. But unfortunately, most financial institutions, and when it comes to real estate, the land registrar, the one who's responsible for administering real estate in Ontario, in most cases requires what's called, what we commonly call as probate, a probated will, or a certificate of estate trustee without a will in the case of an intestacy. In the case of a will, notwithstanding that the executor has the authority from the will, these institutions do require probate. Where there is no will, then there is no authority on anybody's part until the court gives them the authority to do so. And as you indicated, there is what's called the estate administration tax, which is payable whenever this probate or approval by the court, if you will, is applied for. So what is probate? Basically, you, in the case of a will, you file the will with other documents with the court. You prove that all the beneficiaries have been served, and the court gives its seal of approval. So now these third party, whether it's a land registrar or the banks or financial institutions, will have some comfort knowing, okay, this has the seal of the court. Where there is no will, there's no authority whatsoever. So you need the court to give that person, which is usually the surviving spouse or the children who survive, if there is no spouse, with that authority. So that tax, or court fee, as they like to call it,
right,
is equal to 1.5% of the value of the estate, value.
And it seems, Vince, in Toronto in particular, not to mention Vancouver, it seems like everybody's become a multimillionaire nowadays because the values of real estate in particular have become quite high. If you're living in anywhere in the greater Toronto area, Vancouver for sure, some people have even recently told me Ottawa, even in Montreal, prices are going up. Mind you, Montreal is not within the province of Ontario. So we see this great, huge increase. And certainly from my perspective as an older practitioner, Even if there were fees and so on related to going to court and so on, it was never a big deal 35 years ago. You know what I mean? It was like, it wasn't a large figure in terms of going to court and doing whatever you had to do. And as I mentioned before, oftentimes in the old days when we did not have electronic registration, you just registered the will and you deposited on title and you transfer it out and nobody thought anything about it. And what Vince has pointed out is, in fact, with Real Estate Ontario today, absent certain exemptions, which perhaps we'll talk about, you can't transfer a property because when somebody passes away, if a client of mine passes away and they're the owner of the property, and the kids think, well, it's no problem, we just sell it, you know, we don't need to do anything. The problem is you can't transfer it to that to anybody because the land registration system today doesn't allow you to do it. That's as a general principle. They say, well, wait a minute. You can't transfer it. This person, you go to a lawyer, and the lawyer says, no, the person's passed away. You have to go through the probate procedure. And that's how they hook you. And once they hook you in that way, then there's a number of things that have to be done under the Estate Administration Act, which means actually including all the assets of the individual and paying that 1.5% fee or tax, as I like to call it, on all of your assets. So that's a big difference between the old system and the new system in registry. You can't, you know, in general terms, you can't run away and hide from it. It's an issue that you have to deal with that never was an issue 40 years ago in the legal practice.
If I could just emphasize, in calculating that tax, in the property that you're including, this is something a lot of people don't understand. Unlike income tax, capital gains, where you deduct the cost of the property when you're calculating the tax,
it's 1.5%. It's your profit, if capital gains on your profit.
Well, this is on the entire value. So I'll give you an example. You buy a property in Toronto, $500,000, pass away worth $600,000. You're not going to pay the estate administration tax only on the $100,000. It's the entire value. The only thing you can deduct is any mortgage. So if there's an outstanding mortgage, that's all you can deduct.
Correct.
By the same token, you're only including real estate in Ontario. You're including your worldwide assets,
because probate is only in Ontario for our purposes if you live
exactly.
here. Right. And if you have property in another jurisdiction, there'll be all kinds of special rules that you would have to address.
And it's not the net value of the estate. So again, unless it's secured, that debt is secured by a mortgage. You cannot deduct it when you're, you know, calculating the estate administration tax. So if you have $1 million estate and $500,000 in unsecured debt,
it doesn't make any difference, does it?
Or it's secured on real estate outside of Ontario.
Right.
You can't deduct it. So it's a problem.
Yeah. And with that, and the flip side of it is not just real estate that you might own personally, but also monies, investments. You could have all kinds of things. Like I've seen very often, for example, I don't think it's a good idea, but I've seen sometimes substantial registered retirement savings funds or registered retirement income funds where the beneficiary is designated the estate of Mr. X. So what happens is the total value of that fund has to be administered because it's payable to the estate of.
Or there's no beneficiary designated at all.
Or there's no beneficiary. Good point.
Or the designated beneficiary has died.
Has died, exactly.
And they forget to update their papers.
And just to excellent point that Vince has pointed out, because I often tell clients that you have to make sure that you look at things. For sure you have to look at things when there's something of major importance that occurs, a death, a birth, you know, that kind of thing. And so this is the case, as Vince just mentioned, you may have designated X as the beneficiary under your registered retirement savings plan or your registered retirement income fund. But if that person has passed away and you haven't updated your records, you're creating a potential liability for yourself. You have to be very vigilant, I guess, is the correct word in terms of these things. And this is something that perhaps people in the past were not so worried about. You know, they used to say, well, you know, when I pass away, very traditional attitude, when I pass away, my kids will take care of it. And oftentimes it's measures can be taken properly to avoid all the aggravation and some of the cost. So we've talked about the real estate, and money's the same thing, as Vince has pointed out. You know, if I have a client who has $200,000 in a bank account and he passes away, Vince, what are you finding that the banks are going to do, you know, once they know that Mr. X has passed away and there is $200,000 in the bank account? Are they going to freeze the account and not allow the spouse or maybe the kids to access those monies?
Well, they start off freezing the account. But they may, for the limited purposes of paying for funeral costs, release some of the funds on a concession basis, entirely at their discretion. But it's certainly not a situation you want to be in where, you know, you have that money and nobody else has access to it. Because, again, if they do allow you to access those funds, it's for that very limited purpose of funeral arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be other costs that need to be paid. And it depends on your relationship with the bank. They may or may not allow you to, you know, take an advance, if you will, from those funds in order to pay for those specific, you know, emergency expenses, if you will.
I guess the banks are worried about their own liability at transferring funds to, in an inadvertent way, to somebody who says, well, how could you have done that when you didn't know who had the legal authority to deal with those monies, right? And that's always an issue in terms of liabilities that I think the banks are always looking at. I mean, every situation is different, but you can imagine if there's a situation where there's maybe two or three or four kids, and one of the kids shows up and says, that's no problem, Mr. Banker. You can give me the money and I'll take care of things. They're very reticent to follow the instructions just of one child, for example, because of the liability associated with paying it out. And maybe other people will come along and say, well, why did you, Mr. Banker, do that when other people have potential interest in the property and the money disappears, let's say. So the two big aspects there, I wanted to talk a little bit about right now, was this question of when somebody passes away. And it's interesting because this past week I had a client who came in to see me, and it's something that we've seen over the years, and we talked about how people used to do things more simply. And that was where property was in the name, was jointly held by a gentleman, with his oldest child. They held the property jointly. And this was done, maybe 35 years ago. So this gentleman has now passed away. The daughter is still alive. And this is actually a situation I have seen another time quite a few years ago, a bit unusual. Vince, I don't know about you, but I'm always very reticent to have, I didn't act when they had the property transferred to them, but I'm very reticent to act on something like that unless it's very well documented, a daughter and her father passing away. Because in this particular situation, what's occurred is the father has passed away, but he was still married. So, Vince, what's the situation today when, and let's say the father in this case is often the case, it's a family home. So the daughter and the father and the mother all live together. So I'm sure that, I mean, it's hard to say because the father's passed away and maybe had a very good relationship with his daughter. So here he is, he passes away thinking that if he passes away, the property just goes to his daughter automatically. So, Vince, is that good thinking or is that bad thinking from what you, from the scenario I just presented to you?
Well, that scenario raises quite a few issues. But as you referred to, if the house was the matrimonial home of the father and the mother, whoever the spouse may be, could be a subsequent marriage.
We should mention to our listeners that this is maybe a concept that people don't realize. Basically, if I'm not mistaken, went into the law, I was going to say, I know it's before 1990, the statutes are updated, but I would say probably in the late 70s, early 80s. I can't remember the exact time that the Family Law Act and the Family Law Succession Act came into effect, but it would have been around that time. I can't remember the exact year right now.
Well, there was a Family Law Reform Act which came into effect in 78. I don't know specifically what the provisions were or if there were any regarding the matrimonial home, but the current legislation, the Family Law Act, came into play in 1986.
Yeah.
And it has those provisions which provide for the special treatment of what we call the matrimonial home. That is,
and that would be the home normally that a couple would live in.
A married couple, right.
And we know that the word married, so that all our listeners are quite clear, mean, quote unquote, legally married. And that applies to anybody who is, quote unquote, legally married. But it does not apply to common law couples. And this is something that people oftentimes don't understand, because definitions have different meanings depending on different acts. So people assume that, for example, if you've been living with somebody for 3 years, it's just as if they were married to each other. But the law distinguishes under the Family Law Act between married and non-married or common law couples. And some people think, oh, well, if you're together for 1 year, you're a common law couple. Well, that's true for immigration purposes, for the purposes of sponsorship and other issues. It's true for tax purposes. I think Vince talked to us about that in one of the other sessions, and he's 100% correct. But under the Family Law Act, you have to have lived together for 3 years. So,
even that doesn't give you a rise to
property.
It's not a matrimonial home for common law couples.
Yeah.
It may give rise to support issues. But as far as the treatment with respect to equalization of property, which is perhaps something you can discuss on the family law program, and the treatment of the matrimonial home for the purposes of jointly owned, joint ownership or survivorship scenarios, they're treated differently than common law couples.
Exactly correct. So this is something that we, in our example that I just mentioned, so Mr. X passes away, and the daughter now assumes that she's the owner of the whole property. So, Vince, what would you tell her? Is she right or is she wrong?
Well, unfortunately, she's wrong, because the property will be, the joint tenancy will be severed, which means that one half of the, if the daughter and the father own the home jointly, and it was a matrimonial home, that is, the father was living with his married spouse, and they were occupying the home as their ordinary residence. And you can have more than one matrimonial home, I should emphasize.
Yeah,
so you could have a cottage and a home and a vacation property in Florida. The property would be severed, which means that one half of the property would fall into the father's estate and one half would be owned by the daughter. Not the entire amount as originally or perhaps intended.
Intended. So here we have a situation which we see from time to time where people think they do things simply themselves, and especially from the past, and maybe in more traditional families, I must admit, that you see this. So now we have a problem, because all of a sudden the daughter does not own the entire property legally. It's now owned by the spouse. So the issue becomes, this reinforces what we've talked about in, even if this occurred in the past, the importance of having a will. Because at least if you have a will, you can start to move forward perhaps in some way to deal with the problem. Bigger problems arise when, and that will may say, for example, I, Mr. X, leave everything to my wife, Mrs. X. Okay, that's fine. There's a severing of the joint tenancy. The wife and the mother, the daughter, is going to get the property. It didn't work out the way it should, but in some way we're going to resolve this issue. But Vince, what happens if, because traditionally we see this with older families of very traditional societies, they decide, well, that for whatever reason they thought it was okay, and they don't want to do a will. So they don't do a will. So what does the law say in that kind of a situation when person who passed away in our example didn't have a will?
Well, we have what's called in Ontario the laws of intestacy. So one half of the property would be owned by the daughter, and hopefully she has a will. The father, if he didn't have a will on his death, unfortunately, that would create some challenges. And I think we talked about this earlier, the distribution of one's estate if one dies without a will is as follows. If they
right.
have a
if
surviving
you can reinforce
spouse,
that for some of us who might have heard about it, what's the
and again this
the
there
formula?
Is a, there is a distinction between married and non-married spouses. Okay. Common law spouses are not included in this equation.
Again,
it's
yes.
only regarding married spouses. They've gone through a more form of marriage. They're legally married, not common law.
Right.
In that case, the surviving spouse obtains a what's called a $200,000 preferential share of the estate. So that comes off the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then the balance is divided as follows. If there's a surviving spouse and a surviving issue, that is a child or grandchildren, one half goes to the spouse and one half goes to the child or that child's heirs.
Right.
If there's more than one child or surviving issue, surviving children or issue of one or two of the surviving children or one of the two, you have more, let's keep it simple. Let's say there's two or more surviving children, then the surviving spouse obtains one third, and the surviving children, whether it's two or more, obtain two-thirds of the balance after that $200,000 preferential share is paid out to the spouse.
So there we have a situation. Now, I was using in my hypothetical example here a property, but Vince, that would be true also of money, would it not?
It would be true of money as well, yes.
So it's the whole picture. It's the whole grouped asset situation. So, for example, in the situation that I mentioned, if especially with what we've seen with the value of real estate here in, especially in Toronto, if you suddenly have a home that's, for example, a $2 million home, and in the situation we described, you know, maybe it's a home in downtown Toronto where the prices have skyrocketed incredibly. And that one, obviously, we're not talking small amount, we're talking maybe $1 million. Plus, if a person who passed away had other monies that were rightfully his, they would get all grouped together to this formula that you discussed, that you described very clearly. And whether or not that's what people want to happen is really the big question, right? I think the answer, unfortunately, is a lot of times that people don't. Now, Vince, the other thing on joint ownerships that I wonder about, and that people have said to me in the past, I know you thought, well, Mr. Martinello, don't worry about it. It's true. I have, I have $500,000 sitting in an investment account with my daughter. You know, I trust my daughter. Maybe I have three kids. It's my daughter, and that's good enough. She'll take care of things when I don't need a will. So, any issues pop out in that kind of a situation, Vince, where you have a jointly held investment account, let's say, of $500,000, three kids?
Well,
maybe the gentleman even has a wife, but he trusts his daughter. He thinks everything's wonderful.
Well, maybe let's step back and just talk about the distinction between jointly owned property and property that's held as tenants in common, which
right.
is more applicable to real estate. Because
right.
typically bank accounts are usually jointly owned on joint mm-hmm. account with right of survivorship. So if the property is held between two or more persons as tenants in common, on the death of that person, his or her share passes to his or her estate.
Right. That's very clear. Yeah.
But when you have joint ownership, and that's a critical term, you have to look at the account. I ask clients to ensure that the account says joint account with right of survivorship. In the case of bank accounts with real estate, joint tenants. They hold it jointly, then the survivor of the owners becomes the owner by right of survivorship. It's automatic, and it passes outside the will.
So that would be something that passes outside of probate,
and
correct?
It's not subject to probate. So to go back to your initial question, that's the whole rationale. Oh, I don't want to pay probate. I'm going to hold this jointly with my daughter. It's usually a widower or a surviving parent, because if they have a spouse, it's usually between the spouses, not an
right.
issue, because...
Mm-hmm.
And even the legislation in Ontario presumes that if they held it jointly between spouses, that's their intent. When
right.
they hold it with the children, it does create some issues.
Right. The issues that you're talking about, I use my hypothetical example of one of the daughters. So, but let's say that this account says on joint account with the right of survivorship, it's held in whatever bank. And now all of a sudden, the gentleman, the elderly gentleman passes away. What issues pop out for you?
Well, the first thing I ask is, what was Dad's intent? Was his intention that the property pass on to the daughter by right of survivorship?
Because at face value, sure looks like that, doesn't it, the banking documents?
Exactly. And if there's nothing in writing, and usually I recommend the clients put something in writing, whether it's a deed of gift or some reference in their will to that effect, in Canada, the law presumes that where there is a transfer between person A to person B for no payment, it's a gift, there is a presumption that the person transferring the property, A, is really still the owner, the beneficial owner, that B, in this case the daughter, is just holding that property in trust. That's the presumption, unless the daughter was a minor.
Right. And
if she's an adult, there's a presumption.
There were a couple of Supreme Court of Canada cases that said what you just mentioned, between a husband and a wife, there's this presumption, let's say, of money's back and forth of a gift and for a minor child, perhaps. I believe right. That's the distinction, but not otherwise. And this is, I think, a really critical point because, as you just mentioned, the daughter may think that Dad was leaving her the money, but the law might say, well, there's a presumption that money really wasn't yours, Mrs. Daughter. It was your dad's money all the way along.
So if there's no issue with respect to, you know, other beneficiaries being involved, so if that
right.
daughter was the only child, it's not an issue.
No, it's not an issue, obviously.
If there's more than one child and the daughter says, yes, I understand, you know, it was held for me and one or more of my siblings, you know, yeah. they'll distribute it, it's fine.
Right.
Where you have a problem is where the daughter feels that it's hers alone and the other siblings think otherwise, which is right. usually the scenario.
Yeah, that's what usually happens.
That's where right. you have a problem.
And so what you just mentioned before, just step by step, it's really important for people to understand that as lawyers, I'm sure all of my clients in particular must be tired of me telling them this, but I always tell them that if it's a gift, it's a gift. If it's a loan, it's a loan. And whatever it is, you have to document it. And some of them, you know, are very reticent to do it, right? In cases where there's a substantial amount of money, my practice is actually to do something called the deed of gift. And we actually lay out that it is a gift. And we even have the beneficiary sign an acknowledgement of receipt of the gift. And why do we do that? So if somebody in the future says anything, there's no question what was intended. And to the contrary, if you're going to lend your daughter, for example, $200,000, you have to document it. You should document it because it can potentially only lead to problems. And unfortunately, I tell a lot of the clients that I'm not in the trusting business per se. I'm in the non-trusting business. So whatever it is that you want to do can be achieved, but we should document. Vince, is that your practice also with clients, or do they react negatively to trying to document what they always want to do with their monies?
You know, some do and some don't. It's all a different scenario, but, you know, in terms of how they deal with it. But the fact that they're coming to me for advice is a good sign.
Yes, that's good.
But yes, I agree wholeheartedly that a lot of the cases that have given rise to these rulings could have been avoided had there been an actual documentation of that person's intent. And you raise a good point about mortgages because this is a scenario I see very often where, you know, the parents are worried about a ne'er-do-well son-in-law or daughter-in-law getting a share of the inheritance for free. And so they want to document it. Typically, it's an amount of money that they lend for them to help the daughter or the son purchase a home, the first home.
Right.
And if it's a matrimonial home, then, you know, family law rules come into play. And so that asset is basically simplified, divided equally between the daughter and the son-in-law or vice versa. If they want to lend the money, then they should document it. And perhaps take back a mortgage as security. And again, it's all part of that. You know, is it a gift? Is it a loan? Is it being held in trust? Parents, that should all be documented to avoid those issues.
And in case some of you think that we're just creating funny issues that don't occur, but day by day, I'm sure Vince and I see this. I had a client of mine once whose son was, sponsoring a woman from their home country. And when she arrived here, and I remember because we did the sponsorship application, they seemed to be happily married for a couple of years. And dad here suddenly decides that he wants to give them the money to buy a house. So I said to him, and I'm sure Vince has had this discussion with many clients, are you sure you really want to do this? Because remember, your child is your child and your in-law is your in-law, and things can change over time. Unfortunately, we have a divorce rate that's somewhere between maybe 33% and 50%, depending where it is in the country. And so I said to him, are you sure you want to give this $200,000, this was a few years ago, to the daughter and son-in-law? Oh, yes, I want to do that. Of course, he'd been listening to me for a long time talk about the difference between a gift and a loan. And he said, yes, and we did the deed of gift, and he gave the money, and they bought the home. And 3 years later, guess what happened? All of a sudden, the marriage is not going so well. So this couple that had a home that was bought for $200,000 now had a home that was now worth $600,000 and had been a gift. And I always remember this as crystal clear, that the client called me and he said to me, Joe, he said, can I have my money back? I said to him, what are you talking about? This is exactly what I told you, you know, like 5 years ago, you know, like a gift is a gift and a loan is a loan. He said, yeah, unfortunately, I remember that conversation. There's no way that I can undo that gift. I think she would like to undo the gift. I said, I don't think so. I said, I'm sure things have changed, and even if the rapport is not so bad between your son and your daughter-in-law, I said, I think you're looking for justice in a funny way. But it's a story that actually happened, and people, you know, sometimes they would be incredulous, but a gift is a gift and a loan is a loan. And on the other side, I think one of the things that I see in particular with, I would call maybe more elderly Canadians, a lot of whom, especially in the Toronto, a lot of them have worked very, very hard. A lot of them were immigrants, and they raised their families, and they were successful to a lesser or greater extent very often, and they worked very hard. And of course, because like most families, they're very family-oriented, they've advanced monies to, as Vince, as you mentioned, to their kids to buy a home. But sometimes they don't do it so formally as with a mortgage, right? Because it's more work, the lawyers are involved. Sometimes there's just a promissory note, something simple. And so the question comes, not so much that, because if a couple received the money, and let's say $200,000 to help them buy a home, and they promise to pay back if required the amount of money, it's not really a big issue. It's a that. But what people don't realize, or some of the seniors don't realize, is that's actually an asset. We were talking about estate administration. If I pass away and I've lent my son $200,000, that's an asset. It doesn't get excluded for estate administration in Ontario. If I have, for example, three or four kids, and I've advanced each of them $200,000, I have four kids, that's $800,000. That's also a debt. That's also my asset. So these are the technicalities that I think a lot of times that a lot of these people don't think about, because they don't think about it in terms of two ways, in terms of estate planning. Like, you know, if you pass away and we have to go through this probate application, you have to include all these loans to your kids. Oh, I don't want to do that. Okay, so how do you do that? So, I mean, there's issues. I'm sure Vince that Vince and I have talked in the past. I mean, can you put something in the will that says, you know what, the moment before I pass away, if I had the benefit of these loans to my kids, it goes to my spouse, and the spouse says the same thing, but if neither of us are around, the debts were extinguished the moment before we died. Vince, what do you think about that kind of a strategy?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this owning property jointly is the main concern, and it raises a couple of issues, one of which is, what is the intent, loan or gift? The other one is probate fees. And you're right, if it's a loan that's payable to the estate and it's still outstanding on death, then that is an asset that has to be included. Where I find a major, major misconception that clients have is that, well, I'm holding the property jointly with my daughter. No issue of intent, only child, or there everybody's in agreement yep. as to how it's going to be divided. But there's either no will or one will. And there's another asset involved that requires probate. That is, the house is held jointly, but you've got an asset of $500,000 GIC, and it's just in the deceased's name alone.
Right.
Now, when you apply for probate, if there's no will or only one will, everything has to be included.
Yeah.
People don't
appreciate what you just said, that because one thing doesn't fit into whatever they wanted to do, that they still have to bring in the value of that property is what
exactly.
you're saying.
Exactly. Exactly. You can't carve out and pick and choose what assets are declared
right.
when you're applying for probate. It's everything that was owned. And if the intent was, yes, I'm transferring it to my daughter, but she's holding it jointly on behalf of the other siblings and herself, you're going to have to include that asset if you have to apply for probate for any other asset. If that's the only asset, or if that's the only child and the intention was that she becomes the owner by right of survivorship, you can exclude it. If the intent that she's holding it with one, you know, for more children, yeah. one or more other children, you've got a problem. So there's ways around it, but, you know, I don't know if we have time to go through it, but yeah. you can deal with it. It just means, as you said, you know, a visit to the lawyer, proper documentation, and it takes time and effort. But depending on the value of the assets, it's certainly worth trying to pursue some of those options, which can minimize the probate fees, if not eliminate them altogether.
And I think that that's another excellent point that Vince has pointed out, is that because a lot of these people have worked very hard to do whatever they've done, and for their families, they have a great sense of this, they want to make sure that things very often are properly attended to. And that is good for the people who want to do that, that they have a sense of, we'll call it peace of mind or whatever you want to call it about that. The other thing that I find, though, that once again in this concept, as you said, that they don't appreciate is that sometimes children are not treated equally. Okay? And this is where I think a lot of, you know, the kids in the sandbox issues come out after death. I had that case once with the Sicilian family where four kids, I think they made four litigation lawyers very happy, you know, for all the fighting over not a lot of money at the end of the day. And it was a very sad situation. The lady who passed away was my client, because at the end of the day, you looked at it and you realized that perhaps by inadvertence and without enough attention to the situation, my client and her former husband had perhaps given child A a certain amount of money, B a different amount of money, C a money, D a money. And the problem was is that it was never addressed by even doing something like putting in the will, whatever I have loaned my kids in the past is deemed forgiven the moment before I died, so that at least you've created a barrier or a wall for them to fight. But very often where you have children treated very differently, issues come out, and sometimes old personality conflicts give rise to that, which again, I tell clients like that, if you've lent son or child one, 100,000, child two, 200,000, child three, 20,000, child four, nothing. Why child four, nothing? Oh, well, you know, he's so well off, he doesn't really need the money, right? That's the standard rule. And that's okay. And you might be right. It's the parents' money to decide what they want to do. But it can lead to a lot of unintended conflict. So you better make sure that these things are documented or dealt with in some way that's going to be enforceable. But it's certainly a problem we see. And I think it's just people don't even realize that's an asset because I used to use this old joke in certain traditional families who had businesses that the money belonged to everybody and the money belonged to nobody, right? Or the business belonged to everybody and the business belonged to nobody because they treated it almost like a communal asset. The notions were very different than what we lawyers look at in terms of day-to-day situations. So, Vince, so we have, let's say we've gone through, the topic is huge, of course, this whole topic of estate administration and assets. So let's just continue on a more simple path for today. So we've done all this and we have a situation where, let's say we have to go by way of estate administration or probate with or without a will. Can you just briefly tell our customers, you know, our clients, sorry, our listeners, what it is that, you know, they can look forward to in terms of doing, dealing with a lawyer and how long it takes to do these kinds of things. So some of the more practical things that they might look at if they've not been familiar with the situation.
Well, in terms of probate planning,
yes.
There's different ways to address that problem. I mean, the important thing is obviously that it's done when the person is alive because there's not much you can do after the fact. And so, you know, it's a question what the client's intentions are. There is in Canada what's called the alter ego trust that's available or joint partner trust that can help minimize probate fees and also act as a substitute to a power of attorney. And what is that? So,
please explain that because a lot of people, when they hear the word trust, you know, it's like their eyes glaze over and they think it's all for like the wealthiest people in Canada, you know, to consider like people have hundreds of millions of dollars to consider because the idea of a trust has, for want of a better word, traditionally has had this connotation. It's used by really, really wealthy people. So what is it? If you were to propose this to a client, how would you describe it to them?
Well, I guess in Ontario, wealth is in the eye of the beholder. Or it's based on how much probate fees are going to be paid.
That's right.
And that usually is a good indicator whether the clients are going to proceed with these planning processes. Correct. I mean, usually it's wealthy clients who undertake these types of arrangements. But, you know, with, as you've indicated, the house prices in Vancouver and Toronto and in Montreal going up astronomically high, it's not unusual to have a house within the range of $2 to $5 million in Toronto.
Yep.
And that could be the major asset. But then, you know, the clients do have other assets. They have their investments and pensions. And they may have, you know, $500,000 or $1 million. So between the house and the pensions, between two spouses, maybe $5 million is not unrealistic. So if you look at that, you know, you're looking at 1.5%, the value of, you know,
$5 million,
$75,000. That's actually more than that, I think. If you look at... about 75. You're right. Yeah. So 75,000, is it worth it? Well, now maybe it's worth spending a few thousand
dollars
on getting this trust.
On legal fees, that's
so,
right.
So what's a trust? Well, a trust is a relationship. It's not a corporation. So a trust is basically a relationship where you have you have somebody who creates a trust that is the settlor, okay, use a legal terminology, who gives a property to one or more persons.
That's the person who sets it up.
Yeah, which is usually the testator, the client in these cases. And they set it up, and so they appoint one or more persons to hold that property. But it's held in trust for other persons, which are usually the beneficiaries who are the same as a will. So think of it as almost like a will that you're setting up during your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's take the scenario where clients A and B are married. The client A is 65 years of age. What he can do is transfer all of the assets that he owns into a joint partner trust, as we call it. And if that is done properly and documented accordingly, where all of the income can only be paid to the person A who created the trust and his or her spouse during their lifetime, and nobody else can use the capital during their lifetime, then that transfer of property will not trigger capital gains. Because remember, if you transfer your property absent qualifying trust, such as a joint partner or alter ego trust, there's gains, capital gains payable on the value. So yeah, you can defer that.
And people have this misconception that if I give my property to whoever, there's no tax because I didn't get any money. That's a false assumption.
That's right. Now, if it's a principal residence, there is no tax. However, correct. If it's not a qualifying trust, such as a joint partner or alter ego, you lose a principal residence exemption.
Correct.
So if it qualifies, important. You maintain that as well.
Right, and that's okay. Very important.
And that
in
takes
our taxation
specific wording.
System.
Exactly. And so to give you the example, I transfer the property into a joint partner trust for myself and my wife. I appoint myself, my wife, and a good idea to appoint another person
mm-hmm.
who's younger, maybe one of the children, mm-hmm. or a trust company. And we hold the property jointly. Because under the registration system, at least with real estate, it has to be held jointly. Because
right. Creates other issues with electronic registration.
Under the land registry system, the director of titles doesn't recognize trust. But that's another issue. So hold it jointly so that upon my death and my spouse's death, that third person, that trustee, becomes the owner, at least on title by right of survivorship. But really, he or she's going to hold that property in trust. And the terms of that trust will... The terms of that trust will be the same as the will. It'll provide for beneficiaries who will receive the assets on the death of myself and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so you avoid probate for all of those assets. And if I become incompetent during my lifetime, that trustee or one or two trustees who are competent can manage those properties as well. So you serve as sort of a proxy for powers of attorney as well.
Yeah, that's really an excellent, good piece of advice, because if you think about it, We've stated before that in our system of law, like the English system, the thing that we call ownership is registered and beneficial ownership. It's the two together, which sometimes people from Europe have a tough time understanding because the concept may be alien to them. So registered ownership may not be the same as beneficial ownership, and a trust may be something, depending on the situation, as Vince has pointed out. So, you know, in the simple terms, it may be something that people really should consider to achieve everything that you've mentioned relating to property passing on and preserving the principal residence exemption, which is so important, and perhaps not even have to worry as much about what the power of attorneys or power attorneys say or don't say, or change if somebody becomes competent, because the person will still deal with the property. And it's very specific, and a lot of people are not aware of it. And so we're very happy today to have given you an idea of what to do, because we've sort of scratched the surface on this theme, because we still haven't gone into, well, what happens when you actually apply for estate administration? And so we've alluded to a bunch of things, and it's most of them the clients are very interested, and we've tried to address some of the misperceptions people have, or just because they just think it is the way it is. And so it just underlines of the importance of having someone who is knowledgeable in the area, because not all lawyers are knowledgeable in the areas of wills and estate planning, to have the right people you can trust so that you can to get the proper advice for yourself and for your family, no matter where you live. If you're listening to us outside of Ontario, the same thing applies in every province, but you have to get a lawyer in the province that specializes probably in this area, or at least has an intimate knowledge of these areas, to really give you the proper advice. I think it's money well spent, as opposed to creating arguments after the fact. So that sort of is going to wind up our program for today. We'd like to thank all of our listeners again, and I'd like to thank Vince DeAngelis once again for being so gracious with his time and his insight. And we hope that all of you have enjoyed it. And we remind you that if you just listened to part of the program and you'd like to listen to the whole program, or you'd like to re-listen to everything that we may have told you today, or you have your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, whoever, who you think should listen to this program, remember, it's going to be, you go to the radiomaria.ca website, you can find appropriate links, and you can listen to us I don't know, it's sort of like a podcast type format, I call it that. And you can listen to the whole program as much as you want. And we encourage you to go to the Radio Maria webcast or podcast sections. Look for Talking with the Lawyer section. If some of you want to listen to some of our Italian programs, even in Italian. But the English program is a separate section. And everything that we've done with Vince in these three programs is there and with some other ones. And it's sometimes a good thing to re-listen to because everything, although it's simple for us lawyers to talk about these things, it's a lot of information and it takes time to digest and understand them. And it's a good idea to maybe re-listen before seeking professional advice. So Vince, thanks once again for being in the studio with us and happy Easter to all of our listeners.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.